Hello, everyone, and welcome to Sanctuary, a Latina Theory Conversation with authors Paula Mendoza and Abby Scher. Paula and Abby are the authors of Sanctuary, a YA novel in which a young girl and her brother must escape a xenophobic government to find sanctuary. Latina Theory podcasters Maria Issa and Jessica Lopez Lyman are the hosts of Latina Theory, a Minneapolis-based podcast that covers everything from current events, race, and gender to edutainment, all in one Spanglish podcast. Sanctuary is available for purchase at People Get Ready Books. Use the code SANCTUARY for a 10% discount. So this is the first event of the International Festival of Arts and Ideas Beyond the Vote miniseries. I'm Laura Ehrlich, the festival's director of marketing. So I'd like to start by recognizing that the International Festival of Arts and Ideas is created and produced on the traditional lands of the Mohican, Mashantucket Pequot, Eastern Pequot, Scaticoke, Golden Hill Paugatsit, Niantic, and the Quinnipiac in the land we call home, Connecticut. We hope that from wherever you are, you take a moment to acknowledge and honor the Native people whose lands you're on and the history of the place you are in. Find out more about Native land near you at native-land.ca. The International Festival of Arts and Ideas stands with Black Lives Matter and with countless citizens in our own city and across the country who are exercising their right to protest the systemic racism at the root of police violence. The festival stands in solidarity with Black and Brown communities who are targeted and abused by unjust systems of oppression. Thank you for coming along with us on this journey. And we'd love to continue centering your thoughts, your questions, and what you're curious about. We invite you to share your comments and questions in the comments section during the event. We'll do our best to answer them toward the end of the event tonight. And now, please welcome Paula, who will read from Sanctuary.
Hi, everyone. It is lovely to be here with you tonight. Thank you for having us, and thank you for giving us space to read from our novel that we're very proud of, both Abby and I. I'm going to just read for 5 minutes, and then we'll jump into conversation. Chapter 1. It took 15 steps for her to die. 15. One for each year of her life, before they snuffed it out. I was supposed to be doing homework. Actually, I was doing homework, but my phone kept buzzing, so I tapped on the notifications, and there she was. I never did learn her name. In the reports, they would call her an illegal 15-year-old or a 15-year-old immigrant, depending on who was talking. The underground reporters would call her brave, defiant, fearless, and the government news would call her
Hello. A little technical difficulties there. I'm Abby, and I will pick up where Paola left off. The underground reporters would call her brave, defiant, fearless, and the government news would call her disease-ridden, illegal, criminal. But as I watched it with my own eyes, I saw that she was just a girl my age, wearing a faded Mickey Mouse t-shirt and jean shorts that were rolled over on top but still looked like they might fall off her skinny waist. She had somehow gotten over a line of concrete ballasts and the chain-link fence stretching across the burnt-out field between Tijuana and San Diego. That rusty, mangled barricade that was supposed to keep people on the Tijuana side. It stood there as a scar, a reminder, a warning. Its sole purpose was to say, stay out, you don't belong here. That girl in the Mickey Mouse shirt had no time for warnings. She had no interest in being intimidated. She looked completely unafraid as she stepped away from the fence, entering the no man's land between Mexico and the United States. The girl was alone, unarmed. Her dark hair was tied back in a bouncing ponytail, and she had a bright red scratch under her left eye. Besides that, her face looked clear, even calm, as she made her way across the dusty strip of scrubland between Tijuana and the wall. Or really, the wall. The Great American Wall. There was nothing great about it, more like grotesque. It blocked out the sky with 50-foot-tall reinforced steel slats and thick metal mesh in between. Every few feet, there were coils of barbed wire strung across, and on top, there was a maze of cables spitting out electricity. The government had spent gazillions of dollars and called in all the reserves to help build this monstrosity, sealing us off from the rest of the Americas. "Stop where you are," snarled a voice through a speaker by the wall. Technically, that girl wasn't even on United States soil. But as the president loved to say, America was the greatest nation in the history of greatness, and we needed to do whatever it took to protect our sacred borders. That was why there was a platoon of Border Patrol officers lined up on top of the wall. Green zombies, I called them, standing at attention in their olive-colored uniforms with pale, expressionless faces. They had the newest AK-87s strapped to their backs and German shepherds circling at their feet as they stared down that girl. Because this was their land. Because it was their duty to preserve and defend the United States of America. Because whatever this 15-year-old intended, walking across in her flip-flops and saggy shorts, she had now become a national threat. Hello, hello.
Hola, saludos, bienvenidos.
Hola.
I'm glad we have you back on, Paola and Abby. What a team to back and forth in this new mundo of virtual life, ¿verdad?
Keeping you in suspense.
Yeah, we all need co-authors for this, right? Tag team.
Exactly.
That's the whole point.
It's an honor to be here. Thank you for inviting us to this amazing festival. Once again, my name is Maria Isa with Latina Theory. I'm the Boricua on the squad. And we have my co-host.
I'm Jessica. I'm the Chicana with an X of the squad. And we're representing Minnesota here. It snowed, so we're cold, but we're excited to be with you all tonight and have this conversation. See.
Definitely. It's from the central to the East Coast. Wow. I have the book in my lap here, Sanctuary, what you heard. These two phenomenal mujeres' work. This is what we love to make sure that our stories are being told on Latina Theory, as well as utilizing our platform en unidad en comunidad to make sure that our stories are being presented for us, by us, and supported by all. Mm-hmm. And this is a piece of work that I'm grateful amongst in this pandemic that we have literature that is telling the cuentos of our movimiento and also bringing conscious to the light of where folks who may not be aware of the movimiento need to get involved. And mm-hmm. It's one thing about being Latinx, one thing about being women of color, one thing about being writers and storytellers, but also about making sure that if there are allies out there that aren't able to be at platforms in which we aren't due to supremacy, that they start to listen and that they start to speak to their communities, because this is fiction to nonfiction. This is real life, you know? And if you look at the news that just pops up in every day, unfortunately, of the separation of children and families. Jessica and I are both mothers. I have a one-year-old and she has a Carmen 6 months already, right? Mm-hmm. Close to 6 months. And it's heartbreaking to visualize the separation. And also, we know what we come from and where we come from in a colonized world, and saying, when is enough enough? When are we going to be treated equal? And when do our children not have to be living in a nightmare to be dreamers? And I want to jump into that questions that we get to this icebreaker always on our podcast, because we like to start by asking a little bit about each of our guests, so that we can not only hear about your work as authors, but also about the personality behind the authorship. So my first question in getting to know the both of you, and feel free, Paola, Abby, to jump whoever wants to be it first. But where did you grow up, and what work has brought you to the point of Sanctuary?
I was born in Bogota, Colombia, and I grew up in LA in California. So I like to joke and say that when we immigrated to LA, we were the only Colombians in all of LA. All the white people, when I would be like, they'd be like, oh, you're Mexican. And I would be like, no, I'm Colombian. They would be like, oh, that's the same thing, right? And I'd be like, nah. So that was my growing up experience. And I grew up with a single mom, and we lived in a poor working class neighborhood. My mom worked her ass off every day. She made miracles happen every day. I would get sent back to Colombia for the summers so my mom could work, you know, 70 hours, 80 hours a week, so she wouldn't have to worry about childcare for the summers. And so I definitely grew up with a very bicultural experience, and with a grandmother who was a very proud Colombian woman and who would tell me, my grandmother, may she rest in peace, but she would tell me one time I was like 6 or 7 and I was with her for the whole summer. And she just told me that whole summer, English is a bad language. You don't want to speak English. English is horrible. Don't speak English. Don't speak English. So by the time I got back to LA, I had, quote unquote, forgotten my English, and I didn't speak English for like 2 weeks. And my mom was begging me, rogándome, por favor, hable inglés. And I just refused to speak English. But all that to say is that the films and the work, I'm a filmmaker by training, and the films that I have told, I have been telling the stories of immigrants for over 15 years. I've been telling stories specifically of undocumented immigrants since about 2010. I'm not new to this work. This is not a work that is, this is not like a story that is, it's just like special and hot for the moment because it's in the political sphere. This is my life's work, to tell the stories of immigrants, to tell the stories of undocumented immigrants, and to tell the stories in full, three-dimensional, dignified ways that are filled with love and respect and nuance and complication, and not create the quote unquote immigrant saint, nor, you know, an impossible ideal that we as immigrants all need to stand up to, but rather a full human being that has flaws and has made mistakes. And Sanctuary lies at the heart of that, at the heart of creating and writing a book along with Abby during an administration who systematically tried to destroy our communities. And implemented the most horrific policies that we have seen in our lifetimes. You know, last night news broke that still, because of family separation, there are still 545 children. This is almost three years later that have still not been reunited with their parents. And we as Americans have to understand that what that means is that our government took children from their parents and 3 years later still has them separated. And it is, as a mother, it is enraging. It is heartbreaking. As someone that lives in this country and holds an American passport, I am disgusted, to know that our government, my taxpayer money, was involved in stealing, kidnapping children from their parents. And that's effectively what has happened. And they're lost in the system. They don't know where their parents are. They don't know. They deported them back to their home countries and they can't find them.
Thank you for opening up with such personal, you know, background and information. It really gives the texture so much. I mean, it's just truth. Unfortunately, these are the truths. You know, this is a piece of work that is reflecting the times, and not necessarily just now, because this has been happening. You know, the injustices of government controlling our lives, specifically our lives of undocumented folks and lives of people of color and indigenous folks, the stories of trauma continue. You know, you think 540 plus, you know, I think when these data comes into rolling, I'm a Boricua, I always think of the numbers of the hurricane when it hit. It is like, the numbers don't exist, just put a plus sign because there's more, hay más, ¿verdad? And it connects that center of saying, how much more, even if you are to relocate or find these parents, but there is that trauma, this war. These children are experiencing war. These parents are experiencing war. And this is that's not a democracy. So thank you, Paola, for opening up that personal interaction with this story. Abby, how about yourself? Give us a little bit about your background. Where did you grow up? And what work has brought you to Sanctuary?
Thank you. It's a fascinating discussion. I grew up in upstate New York, and one of the first ways that Paola and I connected was I had a single mom for most of my life. I lost my dad when I was very young, and I really believed, I lived in a very sheltered community. I really believed that discrimination and oppression to this extent was something in history books. And then I started learning some of the stories of the people in my life that, you know, dear people who sort of modeled on some of these characters who had hid under a sink to escape from the Nazis, and stories that didn't make sense, that felt like numbers, as you said, until you hear that one story where you're like, no, this is my aunt. This is a true story, and this is a real person that went through this. And I worked, I helped some immigrants when I was in college back in Chicago. People who were wanted to prepare for the citizenship test. And I was very confused, like, what would this country actually do for these people, that they seemed so much better off not relying on this country that was treating them this poorly. And then I started writing young adult books sort of by accident in a lot of ways. I think I found writing to be very helpful to talk about some of the things that I struggled with in terms of mental illness or eating disorders. And then I was asked to write a book about sex trafficking survivors. And I was really turned on to the idea of telling other people's stories in a way that connected me to them, connected hopefully readers to people who to me had always felt like such a different life. And one person who I profiled in this book, she had been through things that I had no idea a human could survive. And she said, please don't treat me like a warrior. Please don't call me heroic. Please ask me, like, what's my favorite color? Please ask me, what do I eat for breakfast? How do I, you know, do I like wearing dresses? Because I'm a person just like you. And so when I saw what Paola was writing about when she was documenting people in the caravan and people trying to cross the border, I was just gutted, because I felt like these stories are about real people, and our country doesn't see that everybody is human, and it just floored me. And I really felt the need to be not a bystander, but to be an advocate and to be an activist. And my go-to place for activism is writing. So I felt really grateful to get the opportunity to write this with Paola.
Chévere. Jessica, you're on mute.
Thanks so much for bringing the human dimension to both of kind of your insights, which brought you to this book. You know, I think when, again, gotta hold it up. I love the cover art here, by the way. It's beautiful. And when I was reading this, I teach a lot of Chicana literature, Latinx literature, and I was so happy to see a lot of interventions in this work. You know, the fact that we are talking about folks from Colombia, right? Adding that narrative outside of just Mexico or Central America is so important. Also thinking about the East Coast, the dairy farm, right? Where the mom works, kind of interrupting how we think about perhaps migrant workers or undocumented folks and where they're located. For me, one of the things that struck me too was that when we think about the Latinx publishing pipeline, there's so many hurdles that are there. For example, we know that we are completely underrepresented in the world of publishing. Latinx folks make up 3% of executives in publishing, 2% of editors, 4% of sales force. So the question we have is, what was the process like to get this book published? What were some of the challenges you experienced in telling a story that really gives depth and complexity, a humanity to the central character, right? It's not just some like stock image of an undocumented tale, which we have seen come out in other sources, which we've talked about on the podcast. So go back to our archive there, American Dirt. But what was that process like for you all? What hurdles? And then also, what strategies do you have for other folks that are Latinx writers or interested in telling these stories in order for their work to get published?
That's a great question. And, you know, I think the most important thing, and we know this, but sometimes we forget it with all the rejection that is out there, that our stories are worthy to be told. Our stories must be told. And just because the gatekeepers of the larger organizations aren't aware of that yet, it doesn't mean that our stories are any less worthy, our talent is any less than, or that we should stop. So the first thing that we must do is we must persevere through the structural racism that exists for Latinos, Latinx community, for women, for people of color, for anyone that is not straight, white, and male. That being said, you know, Sanctuary came about in a very non-traditional way, in that it really was my activist work, my work as an activist. I was one of the co-founders of the Women's March, and was very active. I was one of the organizers of family separations, the marches against family separations in 2018. And I had been doing and telling stories around immigrants for a very long time. And so I happened to be just randomly in a CAA, the offices of CAA, having a meeting about my activist work with some agents. And I had mentioned that I had had this meeting with this very big publisher. And I had messed up the meeting because I didn't know who he was. And this is the funny part of the story, is because the day before I was supposed to be, when I have meetings, I research who I'm meeting with. But that day, the day before, I couldn't do it because I had gone and done some civil disobedience and I had been in jail until 2 a.m. that next night. And so I just woke up and went to the meeting and like had this meeting. And basically he offered me to write a book, and I was uninterested, in not the best way. So the person I was meeting with at CAA, she was like, we need to hook you up with an agent. Let me put you in a room with one of our lit agents here. So I was like, okay. So I went and I sat down with Molly Click, who's our mutual agent. And we talked, and she was like, well, there's definitely a book here. Maybe it's not the book that he was pitching to you, but let's think of another book that you would want to write. I was like, okay. And both of them were trying to pitch me into writing a book around essays and an analysis of where we are in this political moment, how I saw it as a woman, as a feminist, as a woman of color, and to write a series of essays. And that was not who I was. Obviously, I have many opinions and thoughts around that, but I myself am not a political analyst. What I am, first and foremost, is an artist. And so I came back home and I started thinking and imagining what was the world that I would want to write about. Who was the world? Who would I want to write about? And this was soon thereafter family separation. And I decided that what I wanted to write about and what I started to imagine was this futuristic dystopian YA novel with an undocumented girl at its center. And it was a wild idea. And I pitched it to my agent. And she was like, well, that was not at all what I was expecting. And I was like, well, great, because that's what I want to write about. Because at that time, there hadn't been too many stories about undocumented young people. in books. There existed some, but there wasn't a lot. And so I wanted to continue to fill that gap of representation. And the great thing is that a lot of writers had that same idea around the same time, because this book cycle, there's been a lot of books about undocumented young people, which thrills me. I'm so excited that all of these voices are getting out there. So I say all of that to say is then we interviewed a bunch of writers, and I fell in love with Abby, and Abby and I continued to work on the book. And when we were pitching the book to publishers, we were very clear, one, that it was going to be unapologetically political with progressive values and ideas. That was just not even a conversation. That it was going to be about a Colombian Latina girl who is visibly brown, which is why the cover is very intentionally this way. And we also wanted to make sure that Spanish was going to be in throughout the book. Like, some, if you don't understand it, that's okay. Like, that's just life. Sometimes we don't understand when you speak in other languages either. So, and our editor, Stacy, what's Stacy's last name? I'm forgetting, Abby.
Barney.
Yes, Stacy Barney. She was our editor, is our editor, and she was extraordinary. And she really, really pushed us into making our characters full-fledged beings. And she never questioned the politics behind it. And she never questioned the racial identity behind it. She herself is a Black woman. And I think that that has a lot to do with it. So there was a shorthand there of understanding, which was wonderful. And we're so grateful to her for guiding us through this process as well.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite things about the book, because when I opened it, the first few pages, you have Spanish and it's not italicized. It's the same type font as the English. And while we might be pushing that like in academic spaces, challenging how we understand language, to see that in a YA was so fantastic. And then I immediately got hooked, because there are a lot of YA books that you can tell that Latinx folks might not be the targeted audience and that they're pandering something. So it'll say, ¿cómo estás? And they'll be like, how are you? Right. In this very like almost patronizing kind of way of translation, that's not even creative in the translation, right? From or an artistic standpoint, writing standpoint. So really amazing that you were able to get that done. And it just shows how important gatekeepers, but also allies are in this process. Like you said, your editor being on board is a Black woman, understanding probably herself from her own experiential knowledge of what it means to exist in these spaces. Mm-hmm. And the book definitely reflects that.
Thank you. I'm glad. Thank you.
I want to get
another shout out for Stacy, because another thing that we said was we needed this to come out before the election. And at the time it was like, well, of course we'll do our best. And then the pandemic happened and it was unclear which printing presses were working and what was going to be published and what was going to get pushed. And she really went above and beyond to make sure that happened. And I think that there's the whole point is that this election is about so much more than just the two people on that stage, right? It's about so many lives that are being brutally manipulated and destroyed. And so we wanted to have a human face on what is going on in this country instead of just numbers and just statistics and people lying in front of podiums.
I think it's very important to just showcasing the diversity of undocumented folks on the border that are captured at the border. You know, we just have this one ideal. We as Latinx folks, we don't. We grow up in our barrios, and our barrios, we're not all Mexicanos. I grew up in a predominant Mexican community. It was the first Latino community in the state of Minnesota, but first generation Boricua. And, you know, I got a lot of love for my Mexicanos because I grew up with them, you know. And but when you'd sit down in front of white folks, specifically in an education system that puts us in these boxes, whether we're born here or not, would state, you know, you have to write about this, or why don't you write about this person? And not even knowing historical content, it's like, we have our own journeys and stories that braid and unify us together as brown people. But there's also this timeline that puts different cells in different places. But I want to get back into the context of the actual book. And how it opens up. You read a little bit about it, with the scene of a young girl being murdered by the U.S. Border Patrol as she walks across the borderlands between Tijuana and San Diego. During this scene, the main character, Vali, is watching with her familia, right? Thousands of miles away. So you think about us being here, whether we are, you know, of a family that has had to migrate and had to go through a naturalization process or not, but you're watching the news, you're watching this now. Given our current political moment where state sanction and police state violence, thinking here of the murder of Black people, police is recorded and shareable. Can you tell us why you opened up specifically with this scene and what is our responsibilities as witnesses to the violence?
It's a great question. I would say that what we've experienced under a Trump regime in the past now 4 years is that of extreme violence. And we being many, various communities, but just for the sake of this conversation, it is the Latino, Latinx, immigrant community in particular that has really experienced violence. And it's experienced violence both in actual shootings, like how we saw white supremacists go and kill people in El Paso because they were quote unquote Mexican. We've also experienced violence in the violent policies that have been enacted, whether it's family separation, whether it's MPP, whether it's ending asylum as we know it, all very meant and very clearly meant to make sure that immigration into this country is as white as possible. So what we wanted to do in this book takes place in 2032, so 12 years in the future, was to really, we based all the immigration violence, for lack of a better word, in the book, based on the seeds of what was already starting to happen in this moment in time, right? So we took something that was happening in 2018, 2019, and like teased it out to 2032, and what would that look like? And so what we arrived to is that this book, and I think that, I hope anyways, we hope that the power of this book lies in the fact that the reader understands that this could very easily happen if we don't make the right decision in 2020. But with the starting of the book with a young woman, she's 15 years old and it's a brutal scene. We're not giving anything away because it happens in the first 5 pages. She's brutally killed in a surprise, like you're not expecting it. We started the book to set the tone with the reality that in this world, immigrants, the lives of immigrants matter nothing to the government. They are completely invaluable to the government, obviously, not to the people themselves. And what happens to society when we accept that? Because also in this moment, and I won't talk about the details about this, but in that moment, that act of violence against this 15-year-old girl is an inciting incident that changes everything both in the United States in 2032 and essentially begins the trajectory of our main character's story. And it also very clearly states what Vali, our 16-year-old undocumented girl, is up against. She's up against a government that will kill anyone without even thinking about it, without even having any sort of guilt. Because they feel that they have the privilege, that they have the power to do so. So that is why we started it. And the book is brutal from that page on all the way to the end, brutal in everything that happens. And again, because it's based on real life, like what's really happening to immigrants in this moment in time. I've spoken to, at this point, thousands of immigrants who have shared their stories with me, and not one immigrant, not one person in this book is inspired by one person that I've met in my travels throughout the years, but every person that I've ever spoken to is in those pages, whether it's in the spaces, in the sentences, in the characters, elements of a story here, elements there. And I've lived with those stories for 15 years. And I'm honored, so honored to have heard them, those stories. And I'm humbled, and I hope I did the stories justice by when we put them down on the page. But the violence is difficult in this book. We hope it's not gratuitous. We hope that it's based in the reality of what's happening, and that it doesn't allow the reader to turn away, but rather opens their hearts and gets them involved in what's currently happening in 2020 in the United States, if we don't want that world in 2032.
Gracias. Bouncing, I know, Jessica, you have a question that you'd like to ask as well. I'll come in after yours, because it just led me into a question that I want to personally ask, unless you're allowing me to,
no, mujer,
to
go,
ask this question.
And then I'll ask it at the end. Yeah.
Just when, you know, you put yourself in position of whether you feel it's a leadership or just a position of be a listener to speak up for folks who don't feel that they have a voice or fear to speak up. What are some of the initiatives or ways that you're taking care of yourself? Because it's pretty traumatizing to not only experience these journeys as an individual, but also to visualize and be there, you know, because you're giving of yourself and you're hoping that you're doing it justice. But, you know, where's justice in your self-care? Because there is a PTSD. I'm an artist. We're both writers, Jessica and I here, whether it's with music or literature, but especially in humanitarian work. This is humanitarian work. This is human rights, you know. What do we do when we close our eyelids at night because we're telling these cuentos or we've been in those spaces of these cuentos and we have folks relying on us to give this message, and it's a PTSD, you know. I'm sure Paola, this is the book gives you a trigger of being like, man, gosh, there's so much dolor, but we have to speak of this dolor. But yeah. What is your way of your curandera remedies, how we like to say in Latina mm-hmm. theory, to yeah. give that limpia from centering?
I appreciate the question so much. And I will say that not just myself, but I would say anyone that's been working under the Trump administration, working in immigrant rights under the Trump administration, has a lot of pain to work through, a lot of anger to work through, a lot of PTSD to work through, because it has been relentless for 4 years. And we have seen our friends be deported. We've seen people die. We've seen, we knew in 2016 when he was elected that shit was going to be bad, like really knew it. Like I had calls with so many of my friends who are undocumented and work in the immigrant rights space, but we could not imagine how bad it actually became. Like we didn't have that dark imagination. So I say all that to say is that, yes, I am not in the best place having lived through the Trump administration, best place emotionally having lived through the Trump administration for the past 4 years. I will say writing it out was its own kind of therapy. Being able to put those stories somewhere for something that I hope is a cause, it has a point. I also will say that I just made an appointment for my first therapy appointment next week. So that is gonna be helpful, very helpful. And I hope that when Biden is elected, we're not going to stop. We can't stop. We're not even going to get close to stopping. But it's a different kind of battle. It's not a battling for preservation, but rather, and it's important, but rather a battle for, justice, which I think is maybe slightly different. So yeah.
Abby, what about you? How are you dealing with all of this? And then also maybe you could speak about the fact that you all wrote this together, right? Wondering about that process, but also I would imagine, like me and Maria love doing Latina Theory because the first 10 minutes before we hit record is our check-in, right, with each other as we're on the front lines of the work that we're doing. So maybe you could also speak to the co-authorship of that.
That's a great way to put them together, because I do think that in many ways, writing with Paola was what made what made this, well, obviously made this possible, but also gave me my therapy. Like, I felt like we worked off of each other really, really beautifully. And also we step in for each other when, like, when it gets too overwhelming in this section, then, oh, well, then I could take this. And then when it gets, when I don't understand how a character could behave that brutally, well, I'll take over this. So in some ways, I do think that we took care of each other in the writing process. Personally, I know I did stay up at night going, how do they get there? You know, and as I haven't experienced this, you know, this exact journey, but in order to be empathetic, to be really in the moment, I did have to channel my own trauma in order to have a really visceral reaction and a true character reaction. So what did it feel like when I lost my mom? And what did it feel like, you know, when I was in moments of sheer desperation? What did it smell like when I knew I had to leave my home? What did it, you know, what did the rain feel like on me when I had to give away all my belongings? And the trauma that you do, that you're talking about, it creeps up on you, whether you know it or not. I think writing is definitely helpful, and it's always helped me through the darkest times. That's why I turned to writing to begin with. And also just, I think I started playing the piano when I could, and being really silly with my kids. My kids like Valley. I think they are exposed to more than I ever thought that I would expose children to at a young age. And like Valley, I started as a bystander in this whole situation, and then I feel compelled to do something. And so there's a need to do something now, that where I cannot stand by. And Valley, of course, is put in a position where she can't just stand by. But she starts as a teenager who just wants to live her life. She doesn't want to deal with all the horrible things that are going on around her. And I think that's really what a lot of children, a lot of teenagers, a lot of all of us are going through today.
Most definitely. We have some questions perhaps from folks that are watching live with us. If you have any questions, you're watching live, please drop them in the comment areas. We have moderators that are helping us channel those. So while we wait for some questions, the last kind of question we wanted to ask, and we can keep asking, we have lots for you, but is just thinking about the lessons here. You know, when I was reading this, and like you said, it's set 12 years in the future, but how scary that it felt like the reality today. For folks that are not deeply involved in this work and they pick this up and this is their kind of moment to be engaged in undocumented experiences in the immigration regime that we have right now, what are some of the lessons that you hope they take away from this text? And what can they do? I think that's a question that we always get. Okay, I'm angry, I'm pissed, or I'm so upset, I'm so sad. Now what do I do? Oh, I think you're muted, Paula.
I'm muted. I can't wait till the pandemic is over and we no longer have to hear or say the phrase, I think you're muted. What I was saying is the first thing that we have to do is we have to organize our rage. And so rage is valid, rage is necessary, but it does nothing but hurt us if it just stays in rage. So we have to organize it. And I get asked all the time, what do I do? What do I do? What do I do? I can't give everyone like their marching orders forward, but I can say you have to research, you have to read, you can't look away from the horrible stories that are out there. You have to know what's going on. For specific organizations that I love, there's a great organization in El Paso, Texas. It's a small organization, and I like to support grassroots small organizations, because your dollar goes a really long way, and they are really doing incredible, important work that the national organizations just don't have the capacity to be on the ground doing. They're not in the nitty gritty. So there's an organization called Las Americas in El Paso. I highly recommend them. Las Americas, also on the other side of the country, on the West Coast, there's a great organization in Tijuana. They work both in Tijuana and San Diego, called Al Otro Lado. Al Otro Lado. So those two, and also very small, and they are lawyers, and they represent folks that are asking for asylum. So those two organizations are fabulous organizations to get involved with, for sure.
Thank you. I want to connect when we're working with our gente, and we are surviving these traumas that are ancestral también. You know, you think about we're writing in the future, but I think back to even in the 90s and remembering when La Migra was breaking in raids in our Latino businesses, and, you know, my friends worrying that their systems placed because they didn't know if their ama or apas were going to come home. So they had to go to their tías or their primas who they hardly knew, but there was a phone number written on their backpacks. Like, these are the realities of when we hear specifically in legislation of, oh, you guys are so needy, or things have to be done the right way. I'm like, the right way isn't by traumatizing us. The right way is by acceptance. The right way is by guiding, not tearing us apart. So it's important when you talk about, you know, the grassroots work. And I'm glad that you mentioned Las Americas and El Paso, because there's a trust in that. You have to have confianza when you're working with our comunidades. And that's important for folks outside of our communities of colors, and especially communities of immigrants, to recognize that it takes a lot from us to be able to trust certain positive initiatives. Like, if our gente say no or may not respond, it's not necessarily that we don't want the ayuda or the solidarity, but at times it's like, where are you coming from? Because we have a government that attacks us, that kills us in reality.
Maria had a question here for Paula and Gabri, about mothers, and we're mothers too. We were just saying, I had to change my shirt because I had wardrobe change. So our question here is, could you talk about your experience with motherhood, especially during this time when our children are in such peril, and how it influenced the creation of this book?
Abby, you want to go first?
Sure. I don't know that I have a good answer, because I've been making it up for 12 years. My oldest just turned 12. I have a 9-year-old and a 6-year-old. And and every day is just completely different and completely inexplicable. I mean, I think we started at a place where my husband and I were not going to, like, introduce the idea of what was going on in the world necessarily. I mean, I remember when the Parkland shooting happened, and I remember saying, somebody's going to tell them on the bus if we don't tell them, like, what went on. And we had to decide, like, who was on their bus that was going to tell them. What were we gaining by not telling them? What were we putting on them if we told them? And they're three very different individual beings. And so when we did decide to tell them, like, I realized it probably wasn't the right thing to do for my daughter. It probably was the right thing to do for my my son. My baby at the time, you know, didn't understand any of it. But I do feel now more strongly than ever that in order for them to heal, as you said, to be active and to process the trauma that's going around, and to understand that they're in school with, not literally, but but their friends are everybody has a story that they do not know everything about the people around them. As Paola always reminds me, there's 11 million undocumented people in this country, and for my kids to not know what people are going through around them, it does a real disservice to not only them, but everyone everyone in our community and everyone in our world. So now I really do talk to them, and I try to be clearer instead of this is a bad man and he did a bad thing. But it's very challenging, especially when we have an administration that does, like, in it's just so unimaginable, some of the horrors that go on. And I have to say, but this is really real.
Paola, would you like to follow up?
I'll keep it short because I know we're running out of time. Mm-hmm. I will say that, you know, I've taken the opposite approach. I have one son, he's 7. And we have taken the opposite approach that Abby had at the beginning. And that was simply because our house is a very political household. His father also is an activist and works at the front lines of racial justice mm-hmm. and gun reform. And so in our everyday conversations, those were just the conversations that were happening at home. And we didn't want to hide who we were from our child. And I think personally, if our child and my child is lucky enough to not have to be afraid that he's going to be separated from his mom because of her immigration status. But at the very least, if he has that privilege, I believe that at the very least what he can do, even at the age of 5 and 4 and 6 and 7, is hear the stories of other children that are living through it. Yes. I mean, obviously there's age-appropriate ways in which to explain things so you don't traumatize them or scare them. Mm-hmm. But my biggest responsibility as a parent, I believe, especially with raising a young boy that will be a man, is mm-hmm. to make him compassionate. And I think mm-hmm. if I'm able to raise him as a compassionate boy, he will become mm-hmm. a compassionate man. And if you have compassion in your heart, we're so much better than where we are. That boy that will be a man will be so much better than so many of the men that are in this country currently. And I think that you give them compassion. I would give him compassion by being honest and telling stories. As an artist, that's what I try to do with my art. I try to endear and create and inspire compassion. And I do that through storytelling. So I guess what I'm putting together right now is that my art mirrors my motherhood and my motherhood mirrors my art.
That's beautiful. And Olivia, we're both like, yes, we always got our babies in, like our poor listeners on our podcast. I'm like, put a choo-choo in there and let's just keep doing the work, you know?
How old are the babies?
My daughter's 18 months. She just turned 18 Aww. Months.
And mine's almost 6 months. Yeah. And they're both, Maria's daughter's middle name's Rosa. My daughter's middle name Rose. So we got a joke. They're going to be like Las Rosas hip hop duo when they get older. Political hip hop coming your way. But I really feel what you were saying there in terms of, you know, living our everyday lives. Our kids have been in the podcast and the educational and activist work we do, the artistic work. And to end, I think there on the moment of compassion, may we raise compassionate young people to be the change that we need and the hope that we can hold on to. So we're coming to an end there. It looks like we don't have any other questions. Any final words before we end? Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you. You all were amazing, Jessica and Maria. Thank you so much for being able to ask the really great questions from a very Latinx perspective. I love that and I appreciate that. And we just want to plug the book because there's a local bookstore that they were plugging, which is People Get Ready Books, right? People Get Ready Books because we support local bookstores because we don't want to support the big guy. So
10% off if you follow their code. So that's really great. We all love a discount. Code Sanctuary. There we go. Look at this.
There it is. That. And then go vote. I don't know if this is free, so I'm not going to tell you who to go vote for, but just go vote. Go vote.
Bring your kids with you.
Yep. Share the way.
And if you aren't able to vote because we know disenfranchisement is real and undocumented folks don't have that right either, but there's a lot of people that don't have the right to vote that are organizing for us. So if you do have that right, make sure you use it.
That's it. Definitely.
Thank you all.
Thank you. Gracias. Pick it up, Sanctuary. Latina Theories, Book of El Mes. And gracias, Paola and Abby. Un abrazo bien fuerte.
And make sure to listen to the podcast. Your podcast.
Check it out. We're on all major streaming platforms. So whatever preference you have, or you can go directly to audioboom.com/Latina Theory.
Wonderful. Thank you. Yes.
Adelante.
Thank you so much to Paula and Abby, Maria and Jessica for your time tonight. This was such a vital and powerful conversation. And thank you to our viewers for participating in the first event of our Beyond the Vote mini-series. I know we just plugged it, but I'll remind you again, Sanctuary is available for purchase at People Get Ready Books. Use the code SANCTUARY for a 10% discount, and the link is right there on your screen. Our next Beyond the Vote event is this Friday, October 23rd at 6:30 p.m., co-presented with the New Haven Pride Center. This special Get Out the Vote event will feature LGBTQ+ women activists, politicians, and performing artists who are working to increase representation of queer people and their values in politics. Learn more at www.artidea.org. And we hope you'll join us. Thank you so much, and see you next time.